Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Sweta, and today I'm joined by Anuk Arudprakasam, author of the novel A Passage North. In the novel, a young privileged Tamil man in contemporary post-war Sri Lanka takes a train journey from the capital Colombo to Jaffna in the north to attend the funeral of his grandmother's caretaker. But the journey of the title is equally the journey as he undertakes to the deepest recesses of his mind, and to the past and the future. An intense thread of longing runs through the novel, the nature of his people's longing that must have led to the events that led to the devastating war, his own longing for the non-existent Tamil homeland of his imagination, the caretaker's impossible longing for the impossible return of her sons dead in the war, his own longing for his estranged romantic partner, among others. Delighted to be joined by Anuk today. Anuk is trained in philosophy and received his doctorate from Columbia University. A Passage North is his second novel. Thank you so much for joining us, Anuk.
Thanks for having me, Sweta.
From the kind of writing that you do, it would seem that the impulse that drew you to philosophy, is it a same version of that impulse that draws you to fiction? And what do you see about the types of philosophical explorations that literary fiction permits that academia or even perhaps a literary nonfiction doesn't allow?
That's a really good question. And it's a kind of complicated question. I guess, yes, I would say that the same impulse that drew me to philosophy when I was younger drew me to literature as I began to read literature, which I really didn't begin to do until I was already kind of well immersed in philosophy. I was interested in philosophy, I think, in the same way that a lot of people are interested in philosophy when they're young, or at least in the philosophical impulse when they're young. A sense of the world being vaster than you know, a sense of things being larger, a sense of wonder, a sense of not knowing, and a desire to maybe, come to some kind of clarity, to come to some kind of relation to that, to all the unknown aspects of the world. And this was really why I began to read philosophy when I was young. I think it was out of a desire to understand, to kind of hold the world still. I liked about philosophy the fact that it was so abstract, and it was a way to kind of separate you from your environment. When you read philosophy, when you read about life at that level of abstraction, it removes you from your more immediate physical environments. And I think when I was younger, that was also something that I wanted. I was, like many young people, unhappy with my immediate environment, with my my life or the life that I had been given. And so I really enjoyed that sense of distance. But when I began to study philosophy at university, I slowly began to get the sense that philosophy as it's practiced now in the university system, in the American and British and in generally in the Anglophone world, is very different from I guess the kind of philosophy or the kind of philosophical impulse that I was most interested in. Anglophone philosophy as it's practiced in America and the UK, is very analytical. It focuses It focuses a lot on our use of language and understanding our use of language in rigorous and precise ways. And there's something very, to me, something that felt limiting about this kind of approach to philosophy. There's a kind of emphasis on rigor, on precision, on clarity that sacrificed the ability to talk about subjects that were less easily made explicit or less easily stated in simple sentences. And so it was these kinds of moods or these kinds of more inarticulate, more difficult to articulate states that I was interested in. And around the time I was 20 or 21, I read a book called The Man Without Qualities by an Austrian novelist called Robert Musil, who had actually studied philosophy at some length himself, who had actually, I think, trained and got a doctorate in philosophy. And he wrote novels, but his novels were, his fiction was really essayistic. It was very digressive. It would involve a situation, a world, and characters, and people with desires and difficulties and so on. But a lot of the actual substance of the text was kind of these essayistic discussions about phenomena that come up in this situation. And so I saw in that novel the possibility of thinking philosophically or writing philosophically in a more concrete way, in a way that was related to everyday life, the kind of life from which the philosophical impulse actually arises. Because when we're young, we don't ask philosophical questions because we've read them in books. We ask them because we're kind of moved to ask them because there's something that we don't understand, even though we sense that something is there. And so I think it was after reading this book that I felt that the novel had space for the kind of philosophical thinking that I wanted to do that at least contemporary academic philosophy did not.
Right, so almost a kind of showing of those philosophical truths and allowing them to become self-evident in fiction as opposed to, simply stating them.
I actually wouldn't say it's a matter of showing rather than telling. Because, this distinction between showing and telling is a distinction you often hear among, creative writing teachers. I guess it's one of the dictums of American creative writing that wherever possible, you should try to elicit or describe a situation and therefore elicit a kind of mood or a state of mind rather than simply stating that this person feels this way. And that's not necessarily a dictum that I hold to. For example, Musil would often spend a lot of time saying things rather than showing them. But I think that the power of his work was that the things that he says, the philosophical discussions and the digressions, acquire this power that. That they would not have if they were not placed in a kind of more concrete context. So it's not that there is all showing and no saying. In fact, this so-called saying is a big part of, I guess, what I think of as philosophical thinking or philosophical writing. But it's about contextualizing it in the body, in a society, in an interaction, a situation, a history, a culture. So that it acquires this kind of emotional charge that it doesn't have when it's just philosophical theorizing or statement.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. That's helpful. So I was wondering if you saw a distinction between, the kind of explorations permitted by literary fiction versus nonfiction.
Yeah, I do, and it is a common. There is a generic distinction, a distinction in genre, or at least in publishing categories between fiction and nonfiction. And I've heard many writers in the recent past try to deconstruct this distinction or to suggest that it is not actually useful in understanding writing or prose or literature, that many of the strategies that are found in fiction can be found in nonfiction, and that nonfiction itself involves a certain amount of fictionalizing, and therefore that there is something, something simplistic or reductive in distinguishing sharply between the two. But for me, I do maintain such a distinction, and for me, it has to do with the level of identification between an author and a text, or rather between an author and a narrator. The narrator of a nonfiction text is identifiable with the author, right? So the statements made by the eye of the nonfiction text is something we hold the author of the text to. If the statement is false or wrong or malicious or whatever, we can hold the author accountable. But in fiction, there is this. It's a principle of good reading that we don't make this inference from a narrator saying something or narrator feeling something or experiencing something to the authors having felt it or believed it or experienced it. And to me, so there's this fundamental, this to me, that they're kind of different speech acts in the way that asking a question is different from making a command, or berating somebody is different from caressing them. They're two different kinds of speech act. And the difference has to do with the fact that in one, you can make an inference to what the author is like, and in the other, you cannot, or you're not supposed to. And for me, I think that distinction is meaningful also because I don't feel comfortable revealing myself. I don't feel comfortable sharing myself. I like a veil between me and my audience. And the fact that in fiction you cannot make this inference from narrator to author creates this distance for me, this useful distance that allows me to talk, that allows me to say what I want to say without also at the same time making myself overly vulnerable or exposing myself to an audience that I don't know. And as I was saying, with nonfiction, you can't do this. In nonfiction, it's legitimate to make this inference from text to author. And therefore, there's this kind of exposure that, at least in the English language, I try to avoid, because I don't want to expose myself to people I don't know. And in the English language, one really doesn't know anything about one's audience. One's audience can be from any place and have any view and any history and any and be part of any kind of community or culture. One has no idea. And I don't like the idea of revealing myself to this kind of stranger who could be anybody.
Right. Another aspect that perhaps kind of, people say distinguishes between fiction and nonfiction is like the fidelity owed to historical truth. So, I mean, wanted to delve a little bit about how you dealt with that. So, in your first book, which was kind of completely agnostic to geographical, historical context, there was scarcely a mention of historical fact. In The Passage North, however, there are, quite a few overt references to rebel groups, to specific people, events. How did you deal with, how did you think about the fidelity owed to historical truth? Did you find, in both the novels, and like, did you find, were there moments of like historical truth kind of impinging upon the autonomy of the character or the event that exists within the local imagination of your novel?
Well, I guess there are many senses in which there are many senses of fidelity, right? There are many senses in which a text might be loyal to the world or the way the world is. And of course, on some level, every text has to be loyal to at least some dimension of the world, or else it lacks relevance to us as readers. But when it comes to representing things and saying this is what it was like to be here, or this is what it might have been like to have been here, I suppose there is this question of, I guess, fidelity. In that sense, my first novel, I did try to be faithful to many of the, I guess, facts or details that I knew to be the case in the situation that I was describing, the end of the war in Northeast Sri Lanka, 2008 and 2009. But with my second novel, the question of, I guess, faithfulness to the world did not come up in so directly a way, precisely simply because I was, that text is located much more in the mind of the main character and in the thoughts of the main character. The external world is much less present in my second novel, A Passage North, than it is in my first novel. And therefore, the faithfulness has to be faithfulness in question is the faithfulness of, the character to the situation in which the character was placed, or into the world that the character was placed. But again, there was much more room. There's much more freedom in this respect than in my first novel, because the external world of this character, his life, his world is much less specified in my second novel. But in my second novel, again, yes, I mean, in a sense, the facts, the situations that he thinks about, at least the historical situations that he thinks about, because both texts are, in fact, fictional, right? The characters did not exist as they are described in the real world.
Yeah, it sounds like all these historical descriptions were kind of mediated through Krishan's thoughts, like whether it was Kotimani's death or like these digressions into the life of the Buddha, which the fact that they're mediated through his thoughts almost feels like a relaxation of the burden of historical accuracy.
Yeah, or at least the complication of that burden, because, I think that's very true. In my first novel, the character was walking through a camp that is being bombed by the government in Northeast Sri Lanka in early 2009. Then the way the bombs fall, the way the bunkers are built, the way operations are conducted by the doctors and nurses at the hospital, these are not necessarily presented as things that the protagonist is... As they are presented as the things that the protagonist is perceiving, but they are also very much presented directly. The reader sees the camp directly, and in that sense, the reader doesn't see Kuttimani directly. The readers in my second novel, the reader's perception of the world that Krishan is in is very much more mediated through his thoughts and feelings. But again, yeah, I did feel with my first novel that I needed to. I needed to, for example, the geography of the camps, the progress of the government forces against the Tamil Tiger forces, the kinds of bombs that were being used, the sounds that they made, all of these, I wanted them to be accurate. I wanted them to be right. I wanted the fiction to be in the context of, I wanted the context in which the fiction is taking place to be true, as true as possible to the situation. And again, in my second novel, there's no situation as such. There's a funeral that the main character is traveling to, but everything that is described is in his mind as he's going to the funeral. I don't know if that was actually an answer to your question.
No.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Move on to a few things about the book itself. So yeah, through the whole novel, there's this thread of lack and emptiness and longing running through the book, right? So having read both the first and the second book, it seemed to run through both the books, just different, you know, just took different forms in the two, right? So in Dinesh's case, where the end of the project for a separate state and the utter trauma of devastation and like the just the total annihilation of possibility, right, that he has no other choice but to inhabit the immediacy of the present, and all the emptiness that is focused on the immediacy of the present, it seemed like. Mm-hmm. And in the second, it seems to take, where you've mentioned before, take the form of distances, like forays into the past or the future. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I was wondering how you saw the nature of emptiness or longing in the first novel different to the second.
That's a really good question, and I haven't thought of it. But if there is, there are two different kinds of emptiness, because if we can say that the character of the first novel, Dinesh, who is in the midst of this genocide, has an emptiness, I would say that's the emptiness. This is the emptiness of trauma. This is the emptying out of the self that results from being exposed to extreme violence. The main character at the beginning of the book is totally alienated from his family, from his home, from his language. Nobody talks in the camp, or nobody talks in the way people used to talk. He's alienated, ultimately, also from his body, which from seeing all of these dead bodies around him, these body parts, from seeing the bodies of the people around him subjected to such extreme violence, he himself has become cut off from his body. He's cut off from all of these things, and in that sense, he's kind of a shell of a person. So the emptiness it's not an emptiness that we think of in terms of, oh, what can fill this emptiness, or what can fulfill this emptiness. It's an emptiness that results from taking what is there and removing it, from extinguishing it, from a kind of extinction of the contents of the self. Whereas with the second novel, we're dealing with a privileged, educated, upper middle class or middle class man in Colombo, a young Tamil man, who is not himself immediately subject to the horrors of the war, because he grew up in Colombo, and therefore the emptiness that he feels is a much more I don't know whether I'd call it a future oriented emptiness, insofar as part of the question of the book is the question of, is there a future, or how could we understand a future after this? But it's an emptiness that is asking to be filled. It's not an emptiness that's created out of violence, if that makes sense.
Right. So in the second book, I thought emptiness It seemed to kind of creep in into really innocuous moments as well. So, you know, regardless of whether a specific want was fulfilled or not, right? So, for example, there's this, you know, when Krishan is coming back home after that night of revelry and he's trying to stave off feelings of emptiness. That was one kind of emptiness. And then there's the where you evoke the Meghaduta, the Yaksha, eventually getting to the desired destination and then finding that there's really perhaps the emptiness of there being nothing, you know, no message to convey. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, how do you... I was just curious how you would like categorize the different types of emptiness.
Yeah, it's another good question. I mean, each of these characters, I mean, I use the word absence in the book, right? Each of these characters feels a different kind of absence. Krishan feels the absence of a future. Krishan feels the absence of a world that would that can flourish or that would fulfill the people who live in it, a world that has been destroyed by the war. So he feels this kind of longing for such a world. Whereas his grandmother, the absence she has is the absence of simply the world as she knows it. And she's being removed from the world as she ages, as she withdraws physically, as she... loses her perception and loses her mobility. So she also has a certain kind of emptiness, but it's not a future-oriented emptiness. It's a kind of emptiness that is that has to do with the present. The present is being taken away from her. The same present that, for example, Krishan is not satisfied by, that Krishan is trying to escape from. And for example, Rani, who is Appamma's caretaker, who is the grandmother's caretaker, she seeks the world that existed in the past. She seeks the world that contained her two sons, both of whom died during the end of the war. She also feels a kind of absence. Hers is a closer to a kind of traumatic absence, closer to the kind of absence that Dinesh feels in the first book. But yeah, in a way, the book is a kind of study of different kinds of absence, so as you say, different kinds of emptiness and the different kinds of longing that result from them.
So you also make the distinction between desire and longing in the book, desire sort of being object-oriented while yearning is a more generalized condition of longing in the abstract. And my question was about when desire, you know, turns into yearning and how you see that. For instance, there are a couple of instances, at least, one being where Krishan, in moments of desperate longing for his estranged romantic partner, Anjum, turns to the Shiva Puranam, this ancient Tamil hymn that speaks about having to endure earthly desires while all the while yearning to give up earthly life and attain Lord Shiva. I saw that as kind of sublimation of, you know, desire into yearning. And another is the, you know, when Krishan tries to rationalize the growing distance between Anjum and himself in terms of Anjum's otherworldly yearning, you know, the sense that he so vividly senses that what she's seeking can only be fulfilled through something else, and it's this otherworldly longing. So yeah, how do you see desire having to turn into yearning?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And yeah, I don't think that there is in this case, I don't think there is a sharp distinction to be made between yearning and desire in terms of the objects that they're directed to, right? Because I have there in the text said that yearning is what desire becomes when the object of desire vanishes, when there is no object. But we are familiar with the objects of our desire in varying degrees. For example, we might be in love with somebody who is close to us and who is in our life or is a friend or a colleague or something like this. And in this case, the object of desire can be very specific. Whereas we could also desire something, a person that, for example, that we know very little about. Maybe we've seen them, but we haven't talked to them. And in this case, the object of desire would be less specified, less specific. And in that sense, it would be closer to a kind of yearning. For example, Krishan at one point concretely desires Anjum in the sense that that he has seen her and that he has engaged with her. And in this sense, he's familiar with her. But when the book is taking place, when 4 years after the end of the relationship, he realizes he hardly knows Anjum anymore. He wonders how she might have changed. She knows that she's not the kind of person who stays the same. And at that point, 4 years on from having seen this person, having no idea where she is or how she lives, the object of his desire is much closer to a kind of yearning, right? Because the object has lost specificity over time as over the course of their separation. So it's not the object can become more specific, it can become more concrete and more concretely specifiable, or it can kind of lose substance, it can dissipate or evaporate. And for me, this was kind of part of the beauty of this Meghadutta, of the cloud messenger.
Right. Thanks for that answer. So, like you said, the central question of the novel is whether there is a future, right? So I was wondering how you see the place for yearning or longing and desire. What is the place for them in what constitutes a flourishing human life, right? You know, there's a notion of desirelessness as death in the material, worldly sense. And it would seem like in order to, it almost seems like it, one ought to just keep the sort of edge of longing visible, but just constantly just a little far out of reach, right? If one wants to not be tormented by emptiness.
Yeah. Because it's a really good question. It's a really complicated question. And it's actually something that I thought about a lot as I wrote my dissertation, actually. And it's difficult to give an answer. Many different thinkers in different traditions, religious traditions, philosophical traditions, have different ways of approaching this question. In the context of South Asian, broadly speaking, South Asian religion and philosophy, there's a tendency to be suspicious of desire, to view it as, there's also a strong tradition of suspicion of desire in Christian thought, but in South Asian, in Hindu and Buddhist thought, there is, I wouldn't say suspicion is not the right word, but a certain, there's this idea that desire is harmful, that it submerges the individual in the world from which the individual actually needs to be liberated. And of course, this is like rooted in a worldview about, you know, rebirth and karma that is very, you know, that is culturally specific, and that I don't know that people would necessarily hold such views, many people, at least today. But for me, I would say that desire is very important. I think of the visions of desirelessness that you get in different religious traditions. In the Abrahamic traditions, in Christianity and Islam, you have this idea of heaven as a place where there can be no desire because there's a kind of endless fulfillment, right? One is not desiring because one is always in the state of satisfaction. It's this kind of endless, this endless fulfillment. And there is some such idea of like some similar kind of idea in like say the Buddhist idea of nirvana, in various like Hindu ideas of whatever liberation or moksha or whatever. But in all these cases, there's this kind of like, these pictures of desireless fulfillment are pictures that are very static. They don't involve movement. One doesn't need to move because one has everything one needs. There's a kind of fixity. There's a kind of to these images of heaven, to these images of fulfillment. Whereas for me, I guess I tend to think of life in terms of movement, in terms of activity, and I tend to think of human life, of animal life as requiring movement, of not just physical movement, of any of various kinds. The movement basically from needing something to obtaining it, whether that's food and water or shelter or recognition or sex or love. So for me, I guess I think of desire. If you think of desire as what leads to movement, or if you think of movement as the central, I guess, I mean, there's this question of whether we think of rest or movement as the kind of basic position of life. And I think in different philosophical traditions, there tends to be this privileging of stillness, whereas so we are still, but being in the world forces us to move because we become worldly creatures and needy creatures. And that we might contrast that with an idea of humans or human life or animal life as being in constant movement and evolution and change. And on this way of thinking of things, rest or stillness or fulfillment are not eternal states, but rather brief moments in life, little moments or periods of stillness or rest where we have everything we need, or where we're momentarily fulfilled, like when we get rest after a fatiguing day, or when we've eaten a meal after going hungry for some time. So I tend to think of desire and movement as very very important to flourishing.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that answer. Yeah, I just had a couple of concluding questions. So I'm given to understand that you somewhat drew inspiration for like the structure of the novel from Thomas Bernhard's Extinction.
Yeah.
What shaped that thought, and like how did you find that panning out? So of course it's quite striking, you know, when you think about it, just the rhythm of the prose really comes forth in like this circular but building up kind of Bernhardian rant. Except that it's outward oriented, right? Instead of like this relentless battering of like individuality almost that Bernhard employs it in. There's that aspect. And then of course this referential way of a lot of these descriptions are mediated through the voice of the narrator as in Bernhard. So I'm just curious, you know, what shaped the thought, to what extent did you draw inspiration from Extinction?
Well, I did, yeah. That's such a interesting question to think about. I suppose what I was interested in, or what I was most impressed by in Extinction, or in a lot of Bernhard texts, is this sustained devotion to a single consciousness, right? To the point, as you say, where it becomes almost claustrophobic. And it becomes especially claustrophobic because the consciousnesses that he's interested in are often paranoid, they're often frustrated, they're often full of rage, and they're often trapped in small spaces where they have to, in rooms where they pace up and down. And I was really interested in this kind of uncompromising devotion to a single consciousness. And, you know, he, like part of how he does that is by using very, very few paragraph breaks, right? And very few sentence breaks also. They're long sentences that kind of flow into one another. There's a lot of clauses and sub-clauses, and very few paragraph breaks. You get this sense of an uninterrupted mind. And this was what I was really impressed with, and I wanted to try to see if I could do the same. I mean, I think of the books I write now. I mean, I'm still a young writer, and I guess I learned to write writing books, writing my, you know, I didn't study writing formally. So I tend to think of the writing I do also as a kind of education or as a kind of apprenticeship. So with this second novel, what I wanted to be able to create the kind of text Bernard does, a text in which we pay total attention to a single consciousness and in which the world, the outside world, impinges very little, in which there's very little interruption or disturbance from the outside world. So I wanted to see if I could make a book out of simply the drama of a mind alone. And the text is very different, of course, from Bernard's, because his texts are full of paranoia and anger and this kind of like relentlessness. Whereas this text, I think, is what I was trying to do is something much more, much easier to inhabit, something that a certain kind of gentle and quiet and generous solitude that's kind of large enough to incorporate all of the things that the character wants to think about. And so I also employed, I used a lot of strategies that Bernard used in his novel, the certain kind of stinginess with paragraph breaks and with sentence breaks. I use full stops less than a lot of writers. Dialogue is not separated and not presented directly to the reader, but is presented again through the consciousness of the character. I didn't succeed in creating a text, in creating an individual that was totally isolated from the world, totally cut off, hermetically sealed in a room. And so the character, at some point I decided the character needs to make a journey and needs to be in the world. But even his being in the world is a kind of spectatorship rather than a participation. But I would say these are the main ways in which I was inspired by the text. And then there's obviously also the plot similarities with Extinction, right? Because Extinction also is divided into two parts. The first is he receives news of death, and the second part is him at the funeral. And so those two parts are the first and third part of my novel. There's a third part of that consists of the journey, the train journey, to the cemetery in the Northeast. That was kind of simply a kind of gesture of acknowledgement, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was really interesting how you sort of employed some of the same techniques in a completely different mode, and, you know, not at all inward looking, but very, like, the gaze was outward in a sense.
Right, yeah.
Right, so great. I think that brings me to my final question. I was going to ask you, what are you reading now?
What am I reading now? Right now, I'm reading a novel called Vadivasal. It's a Tamil novel. I can't remember when it was written. I think in the 30s or the 40s. But it's basically about Jallikattu, which is this kind of rural Tamil Nadu kind of pastime that involves taming a wild and enraged bull within a fixed circumscribed space. There's a movie, a Tamil movie, coming out about based on the book, and there were a lot of these protests around Jallikattu as the center was considering making it illegal a few years ago. And so I thought I'd read the book in kind of preparation for the film.
And I know you said that, you know, you don't like talking about the novel that you're writing, but is there any kind of like the current thematic areas you're exploring philosophically?
I am working on a third novel. This one is kind of set in the diaspora, the Tamil diaspora in New York and Toronto and Paris, and maybe in South India. I don't know, but it is again kind of related to the war, to its repercussions or to its afterlife. But if you can think of the first novel as taking place at ground zero and the second novel taking place 7 years later, and then another part of the island, and the kind of psychological repercussions on that of that event on a kind of Tamil who grew up elsewhere in the country, then the third novel is kind of dealing with the kind of psychological repercussions of the war across continents in the diaspora. So it's even more removed from the war and from the island, but it's still dealing very much with, I guess, the afterlife of violence in the island.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much, Anuk.
Thank you. Thank you for doing it. And thank you for all the lovely questions.
Thank you. Thanks.